free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what's our taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine, and let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom!
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Well, here we are again, ladies and gentlemen. Tom Woods with you. Very glad to talk to you guys again on this, well, for me it's still the morning, Tuesday morning in Central Time. And I'm going through a kind of, not a crisis of conscience, because I haven't done anything wrong, but trying to decide what the best decision is. Like, I can get super-duper broadcast quality audio for the program if I record it in advance like 99% of other podcasts. But then I won't be able to take calls. So the only system that I can use that would allow me to take calls, unfortunately, also degrades the audio quality. Plus, I've got a slightly hot microphone. I have to work on that. We're going to tweak some things and see what we can do. So I can't decide. My view is I want the best audio I can get. And, you know, for calls, well, I can ask for tweets. People can recommend questions that I can ask. I'll tell you who the guests are going to be in advance. But I'd rather have crystal clear quality audio. I'm a bit... I'm not quite a full-fledged audiophile, but it is a concern to me. So anyway, I'm thinking about this. I'm not exactly sure what avenue I'm going to take. But for now, it's certainly adequate. You can hear me, and we'll see what the future holds. And then in the future, these early episodes will be like collector's items, if an MP3 can be a collector's item. And yes, I know the program from yesterday is not in the archive yet. We're going to be much faster at this in the future, and we are applying to get it into iTunes, but you have to have produced at least one program to get into iTunes for the podcast. So we've done that, and you have to send them a graphic, and we're doing that. So this will all be squared away by next week. I don't want to spend too much time blabbing to you guys because we've got a great guest coming up. I will say, by an interesting coincidence, the day after I interview Michael Bolton of the 10th Amendment Center, my family gets a beautiful gift in the mail from Michael Bolton, and we're very grateful to him. My wife is expecting our fifth child. So we are going to win this battle of ideas through sheer numbers, my friends. And she has very difficult, challenging pregnancies. There are only certain things she can eat at certain times. And she was craving macaroons, and Michael Bolton sent them to us. God bless him. And my daughter, Regina, 10 years old, whom I took with me on a couple of speaking engagements over the weekend, recognized his name on the package and said, "Oh, Michael Bolton. He started the 10th Amendment Center." I'm telling you, just... the Woods family would make for an interesting reality show, put it that way. But our thanks to Michael Bolden for his thoughtfulness and sweetness on that. Just want to remind you about a few quick things before we go to our wonderful guest. I want to point out that October 11th, I'm going to be in Las Vegas for the Sovereign Society Total Wealth Symposium. I will be in Raleigh, North Carolina with a great many of you for Nullify Now, October 19th. November 4th, this was just scheduled, November 4th, Miami University of Ohio. Then November 20th, I'm going to be in two places, St. Louis University School of Law around lunchtime, and then in the afternoon at Lindenwood University in St. Charles, Minnesota. And then early December, we're still working out the details, but probably a couple of law schools in and around Spokane, Washington. So I'll keep you guys posted on this, and also you can, as always, get details on this stuff over at my events page at tomwoods.com. And then finally, don't forget, this is for my special friends, those of you who are joining me, where we're still working out the kinks, and yet there you are, fearless, listening in. We certainly appreciate that. And so for this week, with my libertyclassroom.com, which is my website where I teach U.S. history the way it ought to be taught, and friends of mine whom you can trust are teaching all these subjects you wish you knew more about, Keynesian economics, what it is, what's wrong with it, Austrian economics, Western civilization, U.S. history, the Constitution, logic, and many other courses coming. Plus, you can ask us all the questions you want for a year. You're going to feel like a kid in a candy store looking at libertyclassroom.com. But this week only, because the show is starting, With coupon code SHOW in all caps, you can take 60% off. I am never offering this again. And after this is over, if you come up to me and say, hey, Woods, I missed your 60% off offer, I'm just going to say to you, you're obviously some kind of lunatic. I never had a 60% off offer. So check that out at libertyclassroom.com. I want to turn now to our guest, who I'm very fortunate to feature here on the second episode of the Tom Woods Show. And that, of course, is Ben Swan. BenSwan.com, Swan with two N's, BenSwan.com is the website. I think you all know about Ben Swan. He's one of these child geniuses, right? Graduates from college at age 15, has a master's degree the year later. He's an Emmy Award-winning broadcaster who spent 11 years in the broadcasting in the El Paso area, then moved to where we know him most, the Cincinnati area, where he was on Fox 19 with his Reality Check segment, which became very, very popular, particularly among Ron Paul supporters in the most recent campaign. And now he has gone off on his own as an independent journalist. We're going to talk about all this sort of stuff today with Ben Swan, whom I'm very glad to welcome to the program right now. Ben Swan, hello.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on. And actually, you're going to be in my neck of the woods here on November 4th. You said University of Miami in Ohio, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So you're still living in Cincinnati?
Still in Cincinnati, yes. So that's very exciting.
Oh, thanks a lot. Well, you know, it's interesting that you and I have somehow, even though we travel in exactly the same circles, we have exactly the same audience, we've never met or spoken before. So I'm glad to have
it's
this
true.
Chat. Well, first of all, before we get into any of the details, but, I mean, I think people are more interested in you than they are in asking about the specifics of different reports you've done. I want to balance both, but I want to start off, I want to let you tell people about your Truth in Media project.
Great. Yeah. Well, the Truth in Media Project, the idea behind it is we are really working to cut through that left-right paradigm in media. Clearly, we believe that there is a false left-right paradigm in politics that people have bought into, but it has now translated its way over the past couple decades, specifically about 15 years, into media. And so there now there's this false left-right paradigm in media, and unfortunately, when it gets into media, creeps into media, there is a lack of truth being reported, because everything is being reported through this lens, through this kind of filter of events happening either through a left paradigm or a right paradigm. So we're working to break that down, and so far so good. We're enjoying the challenge of it. It is a challenge because people are so used to this. You know, Tom, I absolutely believe that most viewers or listeners or readers, when they go to media, they go there in order to kind of have their worldview validated, not to learn. And so when you go to media to be validated, you either run to those on the left or on the right who you think best kind of represent your worldview so that you can hear them kind of echo back to you what you already believed in the first place. So breaking through that is quite the challenge.
Now, you know, you seem to come completely out of nowhere to most of us. Like all of a sudden, holy cow, we got this guy on an actual TV station who's actually saying things that we would want the country to hear. This was miraculous. Now, had you been doing this before the Ron Paul campaign, but we just in the rest of the country didn't know about it, or did Ron Paul change your way of thinking? I mean, how did you get started in all this?
No, what's kind of interesting is I had moved to Cincinnati and had, as you mentioned, had worked on the border prior to coming to Cincinnati for most of my career and covered the drug war. But after moving to Cincinnati, you know, we started this segment called Reality Check. It was only in existence for about 10 months before the campaign. So we kind of needed that time to build it up, and it was growing kind of steadily. And then when we hit the campaign, started talking about issues, you know, things that most people would consider insane to talk about in the local newscast, like delegates and how many delegates each candidate had and what was happening at these different caucuses around the country. And when you start reporting on those things, obviously – you know, we grew tremendously during that time because we were the only ones, not because we were the best at it, but because we were the only ones at it. And when no one else is talking about it, it's pretty easy to have a pretty strong market share. And so we were able to do that. And then beyond that, just kind of continue to grow the brand of talking about issues that we felt were being ignored. And it was through that process that I began to really understand the left-right paradigm. I didn't understand it myself before that. I was just trying to talk about truth. And then realized, you know, kind of how viewers saw things and other media saw things, and that it was really this kind of tainted worldview. So breaking through that, it's kind of been a journey for me.
Who have been your important influences then in that journey?
I think people such as yourself. You were the first person I ever heard talk about this thing called nullification. What are they talking about?
You know, nice.
And starting to understand that process. And by the way, this past weekend, we were doing some events in Idaho, and Michael Wilton was out there as well, and he spoke extremely well about this concept of nullification and what the process looks like. And I thought he did just a marvelous job of explaining
it. Yeah, he's the best. He's great.
He's fantastic, yeah. And so people like yourself, people like Dr. Paul, obviously he's had a huge influence. For me, it's really been kind of a process of, I'm not a libertarian, so I'm a capital L libertarian. I'm a liberty-minded constitutionalist, is what I refer to myself as, because I don't actually belong to the party. But I would say that there have been a lot of libertarian thinkers who are really dramatically shifting kind of my worldview, and not just shifting it. I'm a recovering neocon, so I tell people that. Full disclosure here. That's the
you and me
I
both.
Come from.
You and me
yeah,
both.
Yeah, when you step through that door, as you know, then it's like the whole world opens up, and you see things very differently. And so it's this process of you know, believing in liberty and having to break through again those paradigms that really challenge your worldview.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that you consider yourself a liberty-minded constitutionalist, because I was asking people on my Facebook page, what should I ask Ben Swan? And that was one of the – and by the way, people, don't look for me on Facebook as Tom Woods. So whoever started my fan page used my full name. So the easiest thing is just go to TomWoodsRadio.com and click like on Facebook. And somebody said, well, where does he fall on the libertarian spectrum? Is he an anarchist? Is he a minarchist? Is he whatever? Because this is the sort of thing that some libertarians want to rip each other's hearts out over questions like that. Now, let me ask you, why do you think other journalists get things wrong? I mean, is it because they have an ideological bias? Is it because they have a material interest? I mean, what do you think is the problem?
Well, I think there's a couple of forces at play. One of the forces that I think that a lot of journalists run into is the problem of groupthink. So you have this mentality built into newsrooms across the country of what is acceptable and what is not, and kind of the shortcut to the brain mentality, where rather than really digging into stories and looking at why things happen the way that they do, they merely talk about what happened. I explain it to people this way. The reason why I think Ron Paul struggled so much during the debates was, number one, because no one would ask him a question. But number two, when you did finally ask him something, it took him a long time to answer. And one of the reasons it would take him a long time to answer, if you go back and look at how he answers debate questions, it's because almost every time he was asked a question, he had to correct the question in order to give a correct answer. It was because the question was coming from a flawed understanding. And so he would try to explain, well, you know, the reason that we're in the position we're in is because, and he'd have to correct the question in order to give the answer. And I think that's what happens in media a lot, is that we're asking the wrong questions. But it's not because the journalists or writers or producers or anchors or whoever are doing a poor job of researching. It's because we're not researching at all. We have these almost archetypes that are built into the business that we talk about, and we talk about them in such a way that they're almost a given, a fact. And many times they're not. They're kind of this skewed worldview that's become groupthink. So I hope that makes sense as I say it. It might be a little bit confusing, but I think that's one of the big problems we have in media right now, is that we're not basing questions or reporting on facts. We're basing it on an assumption or an archetype.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, I certainly think that it's not just the media, but I think you're right, that the average person, if he has an ideology, is simply looking to have that ideology confirmed by whatever source he's consulting. I mean, and maybe all of us are guilty of that to one degree or another, but it definitely gets in the way of finding the truth. Now, speaking of finding the truth, this is quite astonishing to me. You apparently landed an interview with, was it president? It must have been after Obama had become president, and you asked him about the constitutionality of his kill list. Is this true? And if so, how did you land that?
Well, it is true. It was actually during the 2012 campaign. Obviously, Ohio is this huge swing state, and so all the candidates and the campaigns come through regularly. I mean, every single week they're campaigning in the state of Ohio. It almost becomes a joke around the state where Ohio is, it's really, they're running for president of Ohio is what it feels like, because they're in so many cities. Well, the station that I worked for at the time, Fox 19, put in a request to interview the president. And the way the campaign is set up, they were actually pretty smart about this. If he came to Cincinnati, no Cincinnati TV station could interview him. But they would offer interviews to reporters in other cities. And the reason for that is because they know if the sitting president comes to town, every station in town is going to talk about him. So in order to maximize exposure across the state, you allow stations from other markets to come in and interview him one-on-one, and now you get the most bang for your buck when he comes to the area.
Got it.
So that's how it works. What we did was we put in our request, and it turned out he was over Labor Day weekend going to Toledo, Ohio. And so they called us up and said, you guys are on the list. You guys have moved up. And by the way, I learned later on the reason we got moved up and got on the list was because the week before I had interviewed Governor Romney and Congressman Paul Ryan together and was pretty hard on them, especially on the issue of the delegates from Maine having their credentials stripped from them. Well, some of the staff people in Ohio saw that interview, and they were excited about it and thought, well, hey, that's great. This guy works for a Fox station, and he was hard on those guys, so he must like us because it's
right.
A left-right paradigm.
Awesome.
And
awesome.
So they moved us up and said, come on down. So it went up there to Toledo and interviewed the president, got 5 minutes, which turned into 7.5, but hit him with some pretty tough questions. And not for the sake, by the way, Tom, of trying to shock people or trying to get these gotcha interviews, as Sarah Palin calls them, but for the sake that these were important questions, I thought, for the American public that nobody else was asking, so if I got a shot, I'd ask them.
Now, I want to go back to your time at Fox 19, and I know that you're out on your own now, and that's very exciting, and we'll get back to that, but it was an incredibly gutsy move, it seems to me, for you to be in that more or less comfortable position and then strike out on your own. So I have a two-part question for you. First of all, was the attention that you were getting, particularly from the Ron Paul people, was that viewed as a good thing or a bad thing by the executives at Fox 19? And secondly, did you feel like you weren't being given the scope that you wanted, or you just thought it would – I mean, like, what was the decision-making behind your – leaving? But first I want to know, did they view the attention you were getting as a plus or a minus?
Well, I think in the beginning it was a huge plus, because when I went to work there, it was nearly a last place station. We were kind of battling for third or fourth place, depending on the ratings book. By the time I left, we were number one across the board in primetime demos. So we grew pretty rapidly. In the beginning, it was very positive, and then, you know, over time, I think it became less positive because there was kind of a fear of those people. And when I say fear, I think a lot of executives are concerned about anything seen as controversial, right? What they would love to have in all media circles, but what you'd love to have is 100% of the people who watch you are happy all the time with everything you say, and that they're, you know, truly fans of what you're doing. Well, the risk you run, though, when you start to really talk about intelligent subjects, and when I say intelligent, I mean not just car crashes and house fires, suddenly, you know, you invite criticism. And so many of the people watching us loved what we were doing, but they wouldn't always agree. And a lot of times people would get angry and feel like, you know, when you break down that left-right paradigm, one day I like what you're saying about gun control, and the next day, well, I hate what you're saying about, you know, due process rights for terror suspects. And so what you find is, you know, there's a lot of controversy, but at the end of the day, people want to feel something. So one of the places we struggled was that the station didn't want any criticism over anything. So I think they struggled with that. I also think they struggled with the fact that other media were more critical of what we were doing than anything. So I had a lot of stories written about me in publications around the country and in trade journals where they would essentially kind of slam what I was doing and the questions I would ask and the things we talk about. And the station hated that. I mean, that was a huge concern for them because, well, you know, are we doing the wrong thing? And maybe we're just kind of kowtowing to the Ron Paul crowd or the libertarian crowd. So there was a lot of, I think, angst for them, and they wanted to get away from that angst, and that was fine. And one of the things they wanted also was to really move to just talking about hyper-local subjects. Let's talk about city council meetings. Let's talk about county commission meetings. Let's talk about local bridges and roads. And we talk about some of those things, but at the end of the day, when we talk about a presidential kill list, that affects every single person living in Cincinnati. The viewers knew that because we grew like crazy, but I'm not sure management quite understood it.
Well, I just can't get over you the career you've had up to now. I mean, it's the fact, first of all, that you're able to build up a following of the kind that you have now, such that you thought it was plausible to strike out on your own, is something that very, very few people in your position can say. And yet, at the same time, it must be, frankly, kind of a scary thing to be out there on your own. I mean, what are the pluses and minuses of the whole thing?
Well, yeah. I mean, anytime you step out on your own, there's risk involved. You're trying to create something new. And in addition to that, figuring out kind of the platform for it. So we were very fortunate that we've had a lot of support so far, and I think we've turned out some really good pieces. What we're doing is we're producing these 5 to 10 minute long videos that we're releasing via YouTube and on our website. Eventually, I think we have 5 more to go for this first set, and then we'll have a full season. We're going to try to place that on Netflix. So we really want to do 2 things. We obviously want to build a strong brand, but more importantly, we want to influence people. We want to make people think about issues in a way that they haven't thought about them before. So, you know, it's a challenge because we're kind of recreating the model here. There are others who, like Glenn Beck or even Ron Paul himself, who have stepped out and done these subscription-based models. And we've looked at that, but we say one of the problems with that is you're behind a paywall, and so it's difficult to influence the culture behind the paywall. So, we're just trying to figure out what it looks like, and there are challenges to it. It's certainly more challenging to go off and start something than just go work for someone and stay specifically in your specific wheelhouse. But it's been a great experience so far, and it's been very exciting. And I think the best part about it is we don't just create these videos. We're also working with different groups across the country to create kind of sustainable plans for how to restore liberty on a local level. That's probably been the best part of it, going around these different communities and meeting people in Minnesota or in Iowa or in Maine and New Hampshire or Illinois, talking to them about what it takes to restore liberty for their individual lives through county commissions and through mayoral races and in their local police departments. That's probably been the most exciting part of it, is just interacting with people that way. But it's been a great experience overall so far.
Talking to Ben Swan, benswan.com is the website, Swan with 2 N's. Suppose somebody said, this guy sounds really great. I've never gotten to see any of his stuff before. What would you say would be 1 or 2 reports you've done either with Fox or afterward where you feel like you really put your best foot forward, you're really proud of?
I think the goal here is essentially to really, as I said, to influence the culture, right? So any way that we can especially reach young people, because this whole message of liberty, this picture of liberty in my mind, is one where we really need to recognize there are a lot of different groups out there who have been separated by this left-right paradigm, who should be working together. And so how do we bring those groups together and find some commonality? So when we talk about like Tea Party groups and Occupy groups, I think Occupy and Tea Party have more in common than most people want to believe. And the reason for that is they both have justified anger over problems in our system right now. And they have more in common than they think, but media has told them they don't. So, working to restore that I think is important. And I think putting the best foot forward means, approaching people in a way that is professional, that has a certain style to it, a certain look to it, that they're accustomed to and they really like, but they also trust. Tom, it's an interesting time that we're living in because alternative media is growing so much, right? But at the same time, while it's growing, there are just a lot of people out there who are still not considered reputable. So how do we bridge that alternative side with the mainstream side?
Well, I guess what I mean is somebody wants to go to YouTube and look at your stuff. What would you hope they would see? What's the best Ben Swan video ever?
Oh, I see what you're saying. You know, there's a number of them. If you go to the YouTube channel, you're going to see this whole playlist. Probably the strongest one that we have had so far, even though I think the quality of it is not quite what the other ones have been because they've been getting better. But we did one during the summer explaining what media was not telling the public about what was going on in Syria. And we explain, I think, very clearly who al-Nusra Front is, who the Free Syrian Army is. We do it in a graphic style that I think makes sense. And I think it's very clear, it's very concise. And if you go and you watch that piece, I think it gives people a very strong idea of what it looks like. Now, unfortunately, if you go and look at it, it'll look like only a few people have watched it because we've had to replace the video. But video itself, between Vimeo and YouTube, over 500,000 people have now watched that video. And it's pretty exciting to me that the response to it's been very, very strong from people who say, we are amazed at how clear you make this information and yet how little of this information is actually out there in the mainstream. So I'd encourage people to see that, and it gives you an idea of what we're trying to do.
Well, I'll tell you, I find it extraordinary. I think it's one of the only times, maybe the only time in my lifetime, where the U.S. government clearly wanted to bomb somebody and has backed down from doing it. Basically, that almost never happens. And to see the scope of the opposition and to see how utterly diminished John McCain is, how can that not make us feel at least a little bit encouraged after the constant smacking down and depression we feel looking at this world? This was a point of light, to borrow an expression from George H.W. Bush.
Well, it absolutely was. And I think that those of us who had been sounding this alarm, you know, I asked President Obama over a year ago during that one-on-one interview about why the U.S. was funding al-Qaeda in Syria. And at the time, I got a lot of criticism from other media and from management that I work with saying, why are you talking about this? There's no al-Qaeda in Syria. You know, this is all crazy talk. And, you know, we see now, and you're absolutely right, it does not happen where the U.S. government positions themselves for war and then stops. They don't stop short. And it was only because of this overwhelming response from the public. So overwhelming that when the president thought his next play, his brilliant play, was to hand it over to Congress and let Congress be the bad guy, and no one thought Congress would back down, even a Republican-held House was backing down so much that John Boehner didn't want to hold a vote because he was afraid of how it would look when they were defeated, because they were going to lose. And so when you get guys like Thomas Massie and Justin Amash who are emboldened by that kind of support, you know, we have a phrase we use often. We say liberty is rising. I think liberty in this country is rising right now, and it is the opportunity for that liberty message like never before. So it is incredibly exciting to see the example of Syria and how, you know, as you said, it's unprecedented that the public would be this informed on something that candidly – not only the politicians continue to not tell the truth about, but mainstream media has not told the truth about this. And they've gone through the same rhetoric that we saw in 2003 on the buildup into Iraq. It was the same rhetoric used in 2013 for the buildup for Syria. And yet this time the play wasn't there. So it is an exciting time in that respect.
Well, Ben Swan, we're out of time, but you're the real deal, and I hope people support you at benswan.com and go and watch your videos. So thanks so much for your time today.
Tom, thank you. And by the way, congratulations. You said number 5 is on the way?
Yes.
We have 5 kids as well. And I'll tell you, number 5 is the surprise at the end is always fantastic.
Thanks,
to
you, Ben. I appreciate it. We've caught up with the Swans. Thank you so much. All right, that's Ben Swan. That's Ben Swan, everybody. Thanks so much to him and to you guys for listening in once again. Don't forget libertyclassroom.com, coupon code SHOW in all caps. 60% off, but once this is over, I'm going to pretend it never occurred. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking to Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull. How did I do that?
The Tom Woods Show.